May it please the Court, Your Honor. My name is Chris Thayer. I'm here on behalf of Appellant United Airlines.
Do you want to reserve some time for...
Reserve 2 minutes, please. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. We're talking about a unique aspect of property taxation that I think, in order to understand correctly, one needs to go back to the bundle of sticks concept that we all learned, or I learned in property law in law school, and that is that the owner of fee simple of property owns this entire bundle of sticks or bundle of rights, and that is everything that you can own if you own property in fee simple. Now, if you give away some of those rights, for example, if you give away some of those rights in a lease, you're handing some of that bundle of rights or that bundle of sticks to the tenant. And the more rights you give to that tenant, the more sticks, the more rights that they are going to get. One of those rights can be how long that lease may be, and so you may be giving them quite a few of that bundle of rights until the owner fee is holding a relatively small bundle. They are going to hold on to something, and that interest is known as the reversionary interest in the context of a landlord-tenant lessor-lessee. Here, what we're dealing with are possessory interest taxes that are imposed on airlines at SeaTac Airport. They fit into kind of a subcategory because normally lessors at the SeaTac Airport would be paying a leasehold interest tax, but for centrally assessed utilities and transportation companies like airlines, they do not pay the leasehold tax, they pay a possessory interest tax. Possessory interest tax is not defined by statute anywhere, but it is defined in the department's own documents and generally accepted to be the right to possession and use of tax-exempt real estate property owned by a public entity for a period of time. Until 2006, the Department of Revenue assessed the airport properties, including United's property, by using a hypothetical lease term of 7 years for all of the airlines. I'm assuming that was sort of a matter of convenience because not all the leases were on the same track. In 2006, this changed, and the Department of Revenue changed to what's known as a direct capitalization model, which, according to the United Airlines experts, and as I would like to point out a little bit further, some of the Department of Revenue's own witnesses' acknowledgments that this new method effectively created a perpetual model that made an assumption of a hypothetical perpetual lease. Therefore, that bundle of sticks becomes effectively zero that the owner fee simple owns. This resulted in a dramatic increase in the appraised value of all these properties, including United's, and effectively assessed the fee value of the property, even though the property is owned by the Port of Seattle, which is a tax-exempt entity. United Airlines petitioned under the manifest error provisions of RCWA 469020. Manifest error is defined under the Washington Administrative Code 458.14005.14, which includes, as one of the definitions of a manifest error, assessment of property exempted from law for taxation. So the Department of Revenue has attempted to portray this issue as a dispute over the value of the property, and I would submit that the question presented to the trial court and the question presented to you is whether or not the methodology utilized by the Department of Revenue for this time period, assessed years 2006 through 2011, did it effectively assess and impose a tax on United Airlines for the tax-exempt reversionary interest of the owner of the property, which is the Port of Seattle. There's two cases that I think are controlling. It's the Pier 67 case and the Duwamish Warehouse case. Both Washington State Supreme Court cases. The Pier 67 case says that you have to use the actual term of the lease when you're valuing a possessory interest, and the Duwamish Warehouse case says that you have to take into account the tax-exempt reversionary interest when you're also assessing the value of an interest in property that is owned by.
But those are valuation cases, right? Those aren't manifest error cases.
They're not manifest error cases, but what they do tell you is, so of course the issues of valuation are intertwined into what it is that my client is basing their relief upon. But the question is, whatever the value, whatever that dollar value was that they appraised, did that value exclude the tax-exempt reversionary interest of the port?
Haven't you lost your argument once you say that it's intertwined with valuation? I mean, because manifest error, what normally is considered to be an example of that, a manifest error in description would be you would look at what they how they assessed your property, for example, and say, oh, my goodness, they've got my neighbor's property in there. They've misdescribed my property. That doesn't require valuation. You just correct what is obviously a manifest error in description. But
yes, Your Honor.
Trying to shoehorn into that kind of category something where they're really not valuing the port's reversionary interest. They're valuing what United Airlines has in the way of a possessory interest in the sense of what would a willing buyer pay for it.
Yes, I won't agree with the shoehorning, but I do understand your position. And I would say this, manifest errors, a lot of the cases that you look at that relate to manifest error deal with incorrect square footage. They deal with a tennis court that doesn't exist or a pool that doesn't exist, or they got the boundary lines wrong, which by necessity means once that manifest error has been found that there needs to be an adjustment to the value because something that was incorrect was included in the value. And here what we're saying, something that was incorrect was included in the value, and the something that was incorrect is that there was not an accounting for the value of the tax-exempt reversionary interest of the port. This is a summary judgment. We're entitled to all reasonable inferences in our favor. We presented expert testimony. The expert testimony offered by the Department of Revenue conflicted with the expert testimony that we offered. We're looking for...
Why don't you draw that out a little bit? What are the precise conflicts?
Sure.
That you see?
We offered Mr. Honeycutt, they offered Neil Cook. The question was, does this assume the method that was used? Does it assume a perpetual lease term? Mr. Cook said no. I would note that there are conflicting statements in the Department of Revenue documents that acknowledge that it is a perpetual, and I would point to CP 304, 306, 309, 320, and 321. Should I continue?
You have 2 minutes. You can use them now or save them for later.
I'll save them for later. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Chuck Zaleski. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I'm representing the Washington State Department of Revenue and King County in this appeal. So the primary issue in this case is whether the King County assessor correctly determined that the underlying issue in this case is an issue of valuation of the type that assessors are not permitted to decide under the administrative refund chapter. And I think the real key to evaluating this case is to recognize what the legislature has done. It's set up two separate refund provisions that taxpayers can take advantage of. The primary refund provision, the one that taxpayers generally use, is the pay under protest provisions. Under the pay under protest provisions, you're going in front of the superior court and asking the court under their general jurisdiction to decide these issues, to listen to the evidence, make findings of facts, enter conclusions, decide what the value of something ought to be. And in those sorts of cases, the trial court is sitting in its general capacity. That circumstance is where just about every single reported Washington property tax case involved, every case that was cited in the briefing in this case came under that pay under protest statute, Pier 67, Duwamish Warehouse, the Washington Beef case. Those were all circumstances where taxpayers paid under protest, litigated against the taxing entity, battled it out in court as to what the value was. Well, in 1957, the legislature also created this other secondary method, which is the administrative refund method. That does not involve the Superior Court's general jurisdiction. Instead, what is set up is county officials, either the assessor or the treasurer, decide issues without any sort of evidentiary hearing. There's no quasi-judicial hearing where the parties are battling it out. What is happening is somebody comes in with in essentially an ex parte proceeding and says, there's an obvious error here. There's a ministerial error here. There's something that's so obvious that can be corrected by the county official without the need to go into court and use up judicial resources to get a court to decide these things. That is the provision that United Airlines tried to use here. That provision simply is not set up to allow a decision by a county official on what the value of property is. And in fact, the legislature very specifically says in 84.69.020, at first it lists the 16 things that county officials can do, and then the very next paragraph says county officials cannot decide issues of valuation. And at the heart of it, this case is about valuation. United disliked the valuation method that the department used during the tax periods at issue here. The undisputed facts, the material undisputed facts in the record clearly show that what this case really boils down to is a question about valuation. And the primary piece of evidence supporting that is a expert witness report that United put into the record. United put into the record at, I think it's CP 232, a report of a valuation expert that they hired. On the second page of his report, at the very bottom, at CP 233, that the expert opines that, in his opinion, the department overvalued the possessory interest that United held in the property at SeaTac Airport. Now, the department disagrees with that conclusion, but the point is that you clearly have a dispute as to what is the correct value of that property. And because
your argument is overvaluation can never grow into a manifest error, even in the form of, for example, saying, we don't care about Duwamish, we don't care about Pier 67, we're going to use fee simple to value these leasehold interests, come hell or high water, that's purely valuation that can never be effectively taxing.
You could get an extreme example where you could say, well, this extreme example is one where it's so obvious that a county official can look at that and say there's a clear error here and it doesn't require revaluation because we know the amount. So an example of a manifest error would be if King County had sent a tax bill to the Port of Seattle and said, Port of Seattle, you owe us $400,000. Well, Port of Seattle would say, well, wait a minute, we're an exempt public entity, we owe you zero. So in that case, a county official can look at it and say, well, clearly they're exempt, clearly they don't owe this tax, so rather than $400,000, it's zero. But what United is asking for is not just some kind of a declaration from the county saying that the department's methodology was wrong. They go the next step and say, not only was it wrong, but we are entitled to $1.5 million.
Well, what I would understand United's argument to be here is they say that, okay, you have, they interpret Pier 67 as saying that you must use the actual term of the lease. And then they point out, they allege are conflicts in the expert testimony where Mr. Cook, I guess, for the department says, no, that valuation method did not assume a perpetual lease term. That Mr. Honeycutt and possibly some of the materials from the Department of Revenue said, yes, actually in 2006 we were, the department was assuming a perpetual lease term. and saying then that that is that shows the sort of manifest error that an assessor should be able to catch and say, okay, we've got Pier 67 and Duwamish here, and then we've got the department and Mr. We've got this evidence that says that they did assume a perpetual lease term. Obviously wrong. Fix it. Why is that not a correct way to think about this here, factually? Because it's summary judgment. They like to go to have a trial.
Okay.
And
so
put these experts on and let them fight it out.
So three quick points. First of all, Pier 67 doesn't say that you have to use the lease term. So if the assessor, county official, had found that that's what the case law said, then that would have been an incorrect issue of law. But really getting to the point of your question, they're asking the county assessor to then go and do the next step, which is to say, here is the amount of the that it was overvalued, so therefore we can figure out the amount of the refund. That piece of the equation necessarily would require revaluing the property, even assuming for the sake of argument that United's explanation of what Pier 67 holds was correct. That would still require revaluing the property. The other point that you made towards the end, I think, is worth emphasizing, is they're asking for a remand, but for what purpose? The trial court in this case, or the superior court in this case, is not sitting in its general subject matter jurisdiction position. It is sitting in its appellate jurisdiction. It is reviewing the action of the county assessor. And so it's not a remand would not require or would not involve any kind of a trial. That's simply not the way their administrative refund statutes are set up to work. Had United paid their tax under protest, they would have had every opportunity to litigate this issue in Superior Court. They would have battled it out with the departments. There would have been battle the experts. The trial court would have weighed the evidence and made findings as to which expert the court agreed with, or that the court doesn't agree with any of them, or what have you. But that's not what happened.
Well, I suppose, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what you'd be relying on in saying that. You seem to be saying there couldn't be a trial in Superior Court.
Correct.
No, there couldn't be a trial where the experts would be put on and the question put to the jury would be, was there a manifest error?
No, the court would be, the Superior Court is sitting, essentially what this court is sitting here in its appellate capacity, and the parties would argue the case to the Superior Court based on the record that was presented to the Superior Court. It would be exactly what happened here.
So it's an administrative proceeding, essentially.
That's right.
It's not really under the APA, though, is it?
It's not under the APA, and so there's some gaps where if this were remanded back to the trial court for some sort of hearing under its appellate capacity, the parties would probably have to talk to the court about how that process would work, but it would not be a trial de novo.
Then why file summary judgment motions?
The summary judgment motion gave the court an opportunity to do exactly what the court would do in an appellate proceeding, which is to look at the record, listen to argument, and decide the case. So it was just sort of a convenient, effective way to get the issue before the court.
I guess you could have also brought a motion to dismiss.
Yes, I suppose we could have.
Or just a hearing on the merits of the appeal.
And that would be probably the normal way this would have occurred. There are not a lot of cases dealing with this statute. This court's Coluccio case is one of the few. So for those reasons, we ask that the court uphold the decision of the trial court.
We have 2 minutes.
Thank you. So briefly, the disputes between the two experts. Mr. Cook's declaration is at CP 170 to 200. Mr. Honeycutt's declaration is at CP 228 to 249. Mr. Cook states that the model he was using does not assume a hypothetical perpetual lease term. Mr. Honeycutt says it does. Mr. Cook claims that the method that the department used accounted for the reversionary interest. Mr. Honeycutt says it does not account for the reversionary interest of the port. Mr. Cook says...
What do you think would happen procedurally? I mean, that's kind of an interesting aspect of the case. You both apparently moved for summary judgment. Did you anticipate there would be a trial?
I did. I believe we're at least entitled to an evidentiary hearing. That was my understanding, and that's the direction that we were all heading.
And so you, at that evidentiary hearing, you would have your experts testify rather than just presenting declarations, and then what would the Superior Court be asked to do?
to render a decision about whether or not that's a manifest error, because I think the challenge here is a determination needs to be made about whether or not the method that was used imposed a tax on the tax-exempt reversionary interest. And it's a murky issue that requires expert input. Certainly,
but ultimately, I guess a trial is in order to resolve a disputed issue of fact. So it comes to a point. I mean, if you had a jury, maybe you wouldn't have a jury, but whether it's a judge or a jury, there's a question that is asked, and the finder of fact is asked to decide it. And what would the question be that the Superior Court would decide?
The question for the Superior Court would be, was the methodology used by the department during this time period, did that methodology impose a tax against United Airlines that included taxation on the exempt interest of the port?
Okay. Thank you.
And was that, therefore, a manifest error under the statute?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our final case of the morning is State versus.